but everything is working exactly as it is. I guess then that we can get started. This is Jim Bowling of the Center for History of Chemistry speaking with Raymond H. Bowney at his residence.
It's Ray Bowney, incidentally.
Ray, it's not Raymond.
It's never that to be
I
Raymond.
I see, okay. I have seen it both ways.
Yes, so. The official record in the Dow Chemical Company somehow or other got to be Raymond, but it has been Ray. In fact, I was the third boy, and my mother expected a girl, so she was going to call it R-A-E. And so when I turned out to be a boy, it was R-A-Y, and that was it.
I see. Okay. You've already answered my first question to a certain point. We're at Higgins Lake, get the place right, Higgins Lake, Michigan. This is the 21st of August, 1986. Dr. Bowney, you were born on January 10th, 1903 in Brave, Pennsylvania. Can you tell me something about your parents, their names, occupation?
My father was English and second-generation American, and so there it wasn't, therefore it wasn't very unusual that he was called George Washington Bowney. My mother was Annette Cather.
And what did your father do?
My father was an oil well worker, and he worked in the oil fields all through Pennsylvania and West Virginia for several years, I think maybe 15 years. And then his father left him a farm in Western Pennsylvania. And so the whole family moved to Western Pennsylvania, and Dad tried to make a farm go, but he wasn't a farmer, and the farm was too small, and he finally failed completely in that, went back to the oil fields. Then he got to be a driller contractor, and finally he started drilling wells on his own, for gas primarily, but selling it then to the big companies. But then he was injured in an automobile accident, taking me to school back in 1924, 25 probably. And he never did recover. He broke his back. He never did recover. But he did have his interest in these oil wells and gas wells, so he managed quite well.
At the time you were growing up, then, was he already past the farming stage?
Let's see. About the middle of World War II, he moved back. He went back. We still stayed on the farm, and we went to school on the farm. But he moved back into West Virginia and started moving. And the farm failed, and he started moving back into the oil business, oil and gas business. First as a driller, and then as a contractor, and finally as an organizer of wells, where he would drill. He would sell maybe half interest in the well. He would own half of it for the drilling and the contracting and so on.
I see.
And that's where he really established a little money.
Now, Brave, Pennsylvania is a little town on the border.
It's the crossroad on the border of Pennsylvania and West Virginia. And we lived there for about 2 years. I don't remember any of this. The first thing I remember, the very first thing, we had moved to Blacksville, West Virginia, which is only about maybe 10 miles from Brave. And Father had gone fishing, spearing, and had brought back quite a few fish. And I was wide-eyed, two-year-old kid watching him. And he finally cleaned the fish, and there was a big fish, a little fish inside the big fish. So I had my first lesson in ecology way back then, how the big fish eat the little fish and the little big fish and so on and so on.
Then where did you have your early schooling? Was it in?
This was all in Western Pennsylvania. We lived in Plain Township, near about 3.5 miles from Grove City. I went to a little one-room school. And finally, at the seventh grade, I took the exam. You had to, in order to get into high school, you had to, from a one-room school, you had to go in and take the examination. So I skipped the eighth grade and went to high school, also in Grove City, Pennsylvania. And we walked, my brothers and I walked 3.5 miles in and back. And then we finally had bicycles, and we rode our bicycles back and forth.
Now, was the farm up there in Grove City, is that... You and your father had the farm, was that up
yes.
in Grove City?
Yes, that was three and a half... That was in Pine Township, okay. 3.5 miles from... And right near this one-room school. About a mile from the one-room school. It was called Cranberry School. Mm. In Pine Township.
Do you remember the name of the teacher that... You had, I guess you had the same person for all those grades then, or...
Yeah, we had probably half a dozen teachers, each one year or 2 years or something like that. The one that, Vella McCain was the one that I remember and that probably had more influence on me than any of the other teachers. The other teachers I just don't quite remember, except I enjoyed the one-room school, and if you're just a little bit brighter than the normal youngster going to school, to be able to sit and hear the eighth graders recite and the seventh graders and the sixth graders, and that was a real benefit to me. I enjoyed it, and it was a great way to go to school.
You learned a great deal, more than just if you had been, your class had been separate.
Very much more.
Now, in what way, you said that Vella McCain had an influence on you, in what way do you remember her that...
Well, here is a good way to tell you how much I made a mistake one day when she asked me a question and I answered mother, and that's what she was to me. She was really a second mother.
Okay.
And she was there the longest too. She was there for 2 or 3 years.
I'm sure you didn't have any science exposure to science at that time, did you?
No, except. On the desk, up front near the teacher's desk, there was an encyclopedia. And if you had free time, you were welcome to go up and take out a book and sit at your desk and read it. So I did quite a bit of that. Mm-hmm. She had a set of books on that and a set of books on the Civil War. And both of them I read from one side to the other, one end to the other.
When you got into high school, you skipped eighth grade, went to high school, that would have been
1917, maybe. 17. That'd be close, anyway.
Okay, the war was just about over. The First World War
was just about
ending.
Over. My oldest brother enlisted in 1918, I think, because he was just in for a short time, And then the war was over.
I see. What did you do in high school? Did you get any science exposure in high school?
I had chemistry and I don't think I had physics even. And of course I had math and algebra, but I took a commercial course in high school. I had typing and shorthand and all that, bookkeeping, all that sort of a thing.
Was there a reason for that? That you had selected the commercial course?
Only that I thought I might use it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any idea of at that time of being a chemist or anything like that. However, about that time, my brother and I both got interested in amateur radio.
Okay.
And we had a Ford spark coil and a Galena detector set, receiver set, and I've often thought many times over how many amateur radio specialists there were, or just hobbyists there were at that time, and every one of us had a Galena or a silicon detector, and we were looking right at the transistor, right in the eye, and none of us fell for it. None of us fell for it.
My talking to Bill Goggin yesterday, he also...
Yep, he was.
...involved in amateur radio very early. Yeah, about the same time.
And my brother continued. He stayed in it, and he worked for the Story Broadcasting Company.
Oh, I see. Yes.
For many, many years. But I didn't. I did continue the hobby, though, until I, in Grove City College, and at the time I finished high school, and the first couple of years in college, I had taken a correspondence course from the National Radio Institute, and had got my first-class commercial operator's license, and had a job on a boat, and that's what I was going to do when I finished Grove City College.
Oh, I see.
So my chemistry professor changed my mind. Also, a scholarship to Case changed my mind.
That's very interesting. And I want, before we get to Grove City, were there any high school teachers that influenced you in any way?
Not particularly. Not particularly. I can remember some I dislike, but I don't I don't remember any of them that influenced me. Maybe my chemistry professor did. I guess I should say that, because I did like chemistry, and it was easy for me, and he did recommend me to Pitt and a couple of other schools as well as Grove City. But money was a big factor at that time, and Grove City was close enough that I had no choice. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it. And beside that, they had the first commercial broadcasting company, WSAJ. Mm. And they made the first broadcast, and my brother and I both worked in the physics department with the broadcasting station, which was WSAJ, and also the amateur radio station, which was 8YV. But we both worked, and we spent quite a bit of time, nights and weekends, running their stations.
When did you decide to go to college? You took the commercial course, so you probably didn't have that in mind when you started at Grove City High School.
No, I didn't. But I don't recall exactly why I decided to go to college. It just seemed to be the thing to do. Oh, my mother influenced me greatly. She was a very intelligent woman, and she had taken in high school algebra and a couple of science courses, and so she encouraged all of us boys to really get down and busy and do things. So she's the one who encouraged us to go to college. Dad didn't object, but he didn't do the encouraging like she did.
You said earlier you were the third boy. Did your other brothers go to Grove City ahead of you?
One, the oldest one, enlisted, so he never went to college. The other, there were five of us, beside Delma, who was the oldest one. Then there were five other brothers, and we all went to Grove City College. And a kid sister, who was 4 years younger than any of us, also went to Grove City College.
You remember what the costs were at that time?
About $200. I don't remember exactly, but something in that order.
And did you have a scholarship?
Not to Grove City.
Not to Grove City, so that you had a...
But we lived at home. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we had moved from a farm into Grove City itself. So when we went to college, we all of us boys were going from into Grove City, and we only had about a mile to ride our bicycles or walk to college.
Now, you said you worked at the radio station. Did you have any other jobs to help support your expenses?
Yes, I had a job continually, all through summer jobs, all through most of the last couple of years of high school. First as a rouseabout and as a tool dresser in the oil and gas fields with my dad. He got me the job. But nevertheless, that was the first thing I did. Then the Bessemer Gas Engine Company in Grove City. And I worked there evenings some, and also one summer. And then I worked for a construction company. We called them the Brain Destruction Company. It was a brain construction company. But he built houses and little factories and things like that. But so I worked every summer somehow, some way or other, and earned some money. And that was my scholarship, was all I needed to go to college, even to go to Case.
Mm-hmm. What courses did you first take when you started at Grove City? Did you start in as a chemistry major?
First 2 years, I just took what would have been their academic college course. Mm-hmm. I did have both chemistry and physics in the first 2 years, and math. But it was about the third year, when I was a junior, and then I began to like chemistry better than radio, and I began to think about that.
And can you tell me something about the chemistry department when you were there?
Seaplane, O.J., I think that may not be the correct initials, but it was Seaplane, and he was a Case graduate, and he was head of the chemistry department, and a man by the name of C.J. Hoyt, who was a very, very wonderful teacher. He taught physical chemistry when I was there. Later, he was head of the chemistry department. But these two people were both had a great deal to do with my lacking chemistry and taking it up later on.
The first individual you mentioned, what did he teach?
He taught organic chemistry and general chemistry, and I think either qualitative or quantitative analysis. Mm-hmm. And he also taught food chemistry. We had a course in food chemistry.
That's unusual.
Yes, for a college that size, it was unusual.
Were they the only two in the faculty at the time in the department?
The only two.
What were the laboratory facilities like?
They were downstairs in what was called the main administration building. Today they would be considered a very unsafe, I'm sure, and a very primitive laboratory. But they had all the facilities, and we had our quantitative and qualitative analysis and organic chemistry laboratory and general chemistry laboratory and all those things. But they were all in the basement of the general administration building at that time.
Were there many other chemistry majors?
I can think of three, and some of them, I can think of four, and some of them were either 1 year ahead of me or 1 year behind me, too. I can't remember clearly.
Do you remember how many students there were at Grove City at that time?
About 600.
About 600.
Pretty close to that.
Now, that would have been 1924. 24, okay. I wasn't clear on the dates.
Yeah.
I guess that was the reason that...
24, I finished Grove City and was offered a scholarship, which really determined the fact that I was going to take chemistry rather than radio.
You had indicated that you were going to be a radio operator on a ship. That was one thing you were looking at. And then by your junior year, you really liked chemistry. Were there other schools that you were looking at, or was it just that Case had given you a scholarship?
Just that Case had given me a scholarship, and the Seaplane, our head of the chemistry department at Grove City, was a Case graduate. Mm-hmm. And he influenced me to go there, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he had something to do with getting me the scholarship also. But no, I did not consider any other school very much, any other college.
Because Pittsburgh wasn't far away, so...
No. Pittsburgh wasn't far away. My brother went to, who took radio and was interested in radio. He did take electrical engineering at Carnegie.
I see.
Carnegie Tech at that time.
Mm-hmm. You entered Case then in...
1924.
Okay. Now, did you get another bachelor's degree from Case? Again, I wasn't clear in looking at the...
Yeah, in chemistry at Grove City. And chemical engineering at Case.
I see.
And then I wrote a thesis. I had, between the two schools, I had enough academic work that I could, it covered my master's degree. So I wrote a thesis on automatic control in the chemical industry. That was the thesis I wrote to get my master's degree in 1930, I think, from Case.
Okay, and that you were already a Dow when that happened.
Yes.
Okay, that we'll have to talk about that. Let's go back to your early days at Case. You remember any faculty? Of course, Veazey, I'm sure, is a person that.
Yes.
You interacted with.
And Smith, Dr. Smith, was still. He was an. Emeritus, I believe it. No, he was teaching. He was teaching at that time. Dr. Smith, and then Dr. Veazey, Dr. Pratton.
Oh, yes. both of whom came to Dow eventually.
Yes, and they were very much tied up with Dow and interested in Dow, too, mm-hmm. even when they were teaching. And Dr. Smith was. And the Smith boys, Dr. Smith's sons, I think there were three of them, or two or three of them, organized and started the this oil substitute company in Cleveland. Can't think of the name of it right now.
What courses did you take then, and why did you move into chemical engineering? You said you got a degree in chemical engineering at Case.
I think primarily it was my teachers. At Case, of course, chemical engineering was not the kind of a course you have today. In the chemistry department, you took all your chemistry courses. But then they didn't teach engineering. You went to the electrical engineering department and took courses for the electrical end of it. You went to the metallurgical department for that, and so on. So you got a nice introduction to courses in different areas. And the chemistry department really just, well, they taught industrial chemistry, which I guess would be called chemical engineering, but primarily it was chemistry.
And what were their facilities like the time you were there?
They had quite good facilities, quite good. For that time and period, we had a chemical building, we call it the chemical building, and they had laboratories on several floors. Kind of mixed in with the recitation buildings, so we had very good facilities, I would say, for that time.
The scholarship that you had, did you have to do anything for it? Did you have to do any student?
No,
teaching?
I didn't have to do anything for it. It was a Griselli chemical company that they were in Cleveland then, and later it was a DuPont. Later DuPont, but it was a Griselli fellowship.
I see. And
I remember it was $600.
That covered your...
That covered my tuition and part of my living expenses.
Where did you stay when you were in Cleveland? Did you have a...
I didn't belong to a church fraternity, so I didn't have a fraternity house. I did belong to the chemical fraternity, Alpha Chi Sigma. Mm-hmm. But, so I stayed in private boarding houses. Usually with two or three others. Mm-hmm. There were well-known places for the students to stay, and all within walking distance of the college.
Were there other Grove City students at Case when you were there?
No. Another Grove City student followed me, and he also had the same fellowship as I did. And if I remember right, ahead of me was a Grove City, Dr. Kendall was his name. And he was several years ahead of me, though, probably 5 or 6 years ahead of me. But he also was from Grove City, and he also had a scholarship Case. So Dr. Seepline took care of the students that he thought would make good chemists or chemical engineers.
That's very important. It certainly helps.
Yes.
Now, you said that you had enough academic work. From between what you had at Grove City, and I wasn't clear on your early work at Case that you could get both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Now, the master's degree didn't come until 1930, and you were already at Dow.
Oh, look, I should have maybe told about this before we're talking about Grove City, but my doctor's degree is an honorary degree, and it's from Grove City College.
Now, what I'm after, though, is your thesis. You wrote a thesis for your master's degree, but you were already at Dow Chemical. You came to Dow in 26. Your master's degree was in 1930, and I wasn't clear how you got a degree when you were at Dow. I mean, already out here at Dow.
Oh, that was a conventional thing to do at Case, especially if you'd gone 4 years to another school and had amassed enough academic work to be worth a master's degree. Then you could work for a few years and you could write a thesis on the work you were doing at your. And this was automatic control, and that's what I was doing in the physics lab at that time. So this was a rather a conventional thing to do at that time.
Okay. So you were actually using your industrial work as a research topic for your thesis.
Yep.
I see.
And the academic work you had amassed just because you'd gone 6 years to school.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or to college, I should say.
That clears up a lot of things, and that's very interesting. I hadn't realized it. Did you have anyone at Dow who was acting as a coordinator with this thesis writing back at Case?
Yes. I guess my first real contact with Case, John Grevy, who ran the lab, was a physicist. And our chemistry professor, Dr. Veazey, when in my junior year at Case, this would have been my first year at Case, explained the thesis of this young physicist in the physics department, and he had evolved a method of detecting certain chemical elements by the time it took and the voltage required to liberate them from solution. And he plotted this on a chart and got that, and he used this as a method of chemical analysis. And Dr. Veazey told us about this and explained it to us and said that this might be a method for automatic control of some chemical processes. Mm. So that's how I first heard about Grevy. Then about my senior year, Dr. Veazey had a note from H.H. Dow asking for two what he called athletic students to lift and drop sandbags during a lecture he was going to give on the use of organic, high-boiling organic chemicals to improve the generation of power. So he asked for these two students, and Dr. Veazey picked Norman Barstow because he was from Midland, and picked me because I was a friend and we were doing a thesis together. Neither one of us were particularly athletic. So we found we could not generate a 1 horsepower for 3 minutes. We just couldn't do it by lifting sandbags. It wasn't possible. Two athletic football players might have been able to do it, but we could not. So we convinced Herbert Dow that half a horsepower would be satisfactory. So we lifted and dropped sandbags during that period. And as I wrote in my introduction to the chapter, we inadvertently demonstrated, I think it was Newton's third law of motion. Anyhow, about the time we finished our demonstration, our ordeal, I should say, the bellhop rushed into the room. This was in the Hollandon Hotel in Cleveland, Ohio. He rushed into the room and said, "You're knocking the plaster off the room below." So for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. But anyhow, that's how I got acquainted with Herbert Dow. I got to know him a little bit, and I heard his lecture and listened to him, and he listened to me and saw me, and between Ormond and Dr. Veazey, I was offered a job at Case, or at Dow Chemical in Cleveland. Incidentally, it was interesting to me, maybe interesting to others too, of the four job offers that I had when I finished Case at Cleveland, three were because of my hobby in radio, and these three were Westinghouse, RCA, and General Electric. Mm. As a chemist, but working in because I was interested in radio. And the only honest-to-God offer I had in the chemistry industry was the Dow Chemical Company. Mm. So naturally, I took the job.
Had you been out searching for jobs as you were finishing up the Case? Were you out actively looking for jobs? Or,
no.
Or was it were the faculty pointing you towards...
I was offered a job, these four jobs, and they just kind of came. The faculty must have had something to do with it, because they did come to me, and I turned down the first three because it was not exactly what I wanted. I wanted to get in the chemical industry. Mm-hmm. And that was the only chemical plant that offered me a job.
That was 19...
That was 1926.
Yes. So you came to Midland in what?
1926 in July.
July, right after you graduated.
Yep.
What was your first assignment? I think you were in the...
I was in the main analytical laboratory to start. That was characteristic of the Dow Chemical Company, too. Everybody went to the analytical, main analytical laboratory to start. So I was in the main analytical laboratory for, I think, 6 months, something like that.
And what kind of work were you doing there?
Analytical work primarily on magnesium alloys. One incident, too, that was interesting to me, and it might be interesting to others. While I was in the main analytical laboratory analyzing magnesium alloys, I had a bottle of what was supposed to be sodium hydroxide. And it was labeled, it was a Baker label on it, at least I don't know where how it got contaminated. But anyhow, it turned out to be sodium cyanide rather than sodium hydroxide. And I found that out in my work and in my analysis of, it just didn't work, of course, the same way the caustic did. But anyway, I did find it out, and I think maybe that had something to do with my first initial notice at the Dow Chemical Company that I was, here was somebody who was curious and was observant and that sort of a thing, because I did find this out and I did notice it and I didn't get myself killed with cyanide.
Do you remember the analytical procedures you were following? I read somewhere you were doing six elements. It took about a week to do the...
Yes. And I don't even remember what they were, but there was manganese in the magnesium, and aluminum in the magnesium, and iron. I don't remember what the others were, but there were about six different elements that we were analyzing for. And then I did other analytical work too. That the sample grabber would bring in samples from the plant, and we'd have to run them in the daytime, or sometimes I worked nights, and he would bring him in, and that was a hurry-up job. You had to do that right now because he had to call the plant back.
Yeah, I see.
But I don't remember what they were, what the procedures were.
Can you tell me something about H.H. Dow in those early years? You didn't go through that student training program. That came after.
No, that came afterward.
Right.
So I didn't go. But Herbert Dow, of course, he was a Case graduate, and he was interested in Case graduates. And early in the history of the Dow Chemical Company, practically everybody he hired was from Case.
I see.
This was very, very usual for him to do that. And so he was I can't think how to describe him concisely. He was a very conservation-minded man. I remember one little story about him, that this was when Grebe was with him, and Grebe told me the story, really. But they were walking out of the hotel room in Cleveland when John was with H.H. Dow, and they were giving this talk on the high-boiling organic compounds. But John was behind H.H. Dow as they walked out the hotel door, and John forgot to turn off the lights. And Herbert Dow turned around and turned off the lights, and then he gave John a lecture of about 5 minutes of the poor miners who had worked to make the coal, to make the power, and here John was wasting it. So he was a very, very conservation-minded individual, and he was perhaps almost as much interested in the power, generation of power, as he was in the chemistry. He was very, very much interested in it. And basically, the Dow Chemical Company, up until a few years ago at least, has always been very, very power generation minded, and they've generated their own power for their electrolytic processes. But other than that, and the fact that here's another little story. The old bromine plant was right next to the main office, and Herbert Dow, he visited every plant at that time in Midland every week. Once a week, he'd get through LLM, and this bromine plant, the old bromine plant, was right near the office. So the manager, Glenn Cantwell, of the bromine plant, saw Herbert Dow come out, and he knew he was going to go through his plant first. And he didn't have time to arrange anything, except he walked in to the lunchroom, which he knew Herbert Dow would have to come through to get to the rest of the plant. And all he had time to do was to arrange all the lunch pails in a nice military fashion. And sure enough, the next day, Glenn Cantwell got a note from Herbert Dow complimenting him on the fact that his lunchroom was in such good order and all the dinner pails were lined up in such military fashion. But he noticed things like that, and I guess the important thing that I wanted to make was that he visited every laboratory and every plant at least once a week, all through the middle of course, it wasn't a big plant at that time. There were only about 1,500 employees, something like that. So it wasn't a huge plant. But nevertheless, he did get out, and he did see it, and he did know all of us. And he had another thing that he did, which I think was pointed out some of his character. Saturday mornings, we work Saturday, incidentally, Saturday mornings. We had a 4 to 5 hour week. But he would, new employees, he would schedule a trip through the plant. And he would personally take all the new employees, which may have been only 3 or 2 or 5 or 6 or something like that, but he'd take us all through the whole plant from one end to the other, explain what was going on, what was happening, and he did this over and over again, Saturday after Saturday.
Sounds like the forerunner of that student training program.
It was a forerunner. I'm glad you mentioned that. It was. It certainly was.
And did he take a personal interest in you? Did he talk to you about what you were doing? Was the analyses you were doing in the lab? Did he talk to you about those at all?
He talked to me, but he talked to everybody, and not to me any more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Grebe, he did. Grebe, he always came in with a bunch of ideas, and he tried them out on Grebe. This is another little story that I have in the first chapter, too, but I think it might be worth telling. But Herbert Dow had lots of ideas, and most of them were good ideas. And he'd come and talk to John about them. And one day, though, Herbert Dow came in, and I was sitting right next to we were all crowded in one little room. But he tried an idea out on John that I thought was a bit crazy, not up to Herbert Dow's usual standard of good ideas. But anyway, John was enthusiastic about it, and he said, well, he would look it up and he'd think about it, and he'd call him back in the morning and tell him about it. And so when Herbert Dow left, I said to John, what in the world made you so enthusiastic about this idea that to me seemed crazy? And John gave me a lecture. He gave me a 5-minute lecture. First of all, an idea is God's greatest gift to humanity. Without it, we'd still be in the Dark Ages. And on. And whenever you hear an idea, don't be negative about it. Be positive about it. Tomorrow's soon enough to be a judge. So try to do this. And I remember that all my life, and I've tried to do it all my life. But This was Grebe all over again, and if you want an introduction to John Grebe, that is the introduction to him. Enthusiasm plus ideas plus encouraging everybody to have ideas and not ever being negative about them when you first hear them.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You were in that analytical lab only a short time, or the main lab only a short time.
Yes.
Did you know before, when you went to Dow, that you'd end up in the physics lab?
No.
Okay.
Had no idea.
Did they tell you, John, when they offered you the job, did they tell you what you were what they had in mind for you as a new technical employee?
No, not at all. Grebe borrowed me for 2 days to help him take data on a Dowtherm, which was this high boiling organic compound that was supposed to improve electrical generation. But he borrowed me for 2 days to help him take data. And I'm sure now, I didn't realize it then, but I'm sure now he did that to get to know me and to decide whether he wanted me. Well, the 2 days grew into 2 years, and the 2 years grew into almost 20, and so on and so forth. So that's how I moved from the main lab to John Grebe. And I was the only one in the lab at that. Well, I shouldn't quite say that. There were two lab assistants, and John had already introduced about, I think, two different automatic controls, or at least sensing devices. And these assistants, or technicians really, were supposed to go around each day and check these and do that sort of thing. But I was the first professional graduate to work with Grebe.
And that occurred still in 1926, didn't it? That was late in the year of 20.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten when Grebe came to Dow, but it wasn't much.
1924.
When you were measuring those properties of Dowtherm, you said that Grebe had borrowed you. How long a project did that turn out to be, or was that just a short term?
It was such a short term. Actually, I took the data on the pilot plan, but then when we took the data, it was characteristic of Dow at that time to very early in a development to operate a pilot plan, build and operate a pilot plan, and then go back to the lab and work out any questions that turned up for it. So I was given the job of measuring the Pacific heat at a whole bunch of different temperatures and explosive limits and a few other things like that. And this took me perhaps most of the first year I worked for Dow. Mm-hmm. First year I worked for Grebe, 18 months worked for Dow. But this also explains a little bit more about Herbert Dow. John Grebe was sent to Germany. When he came to the United States, he came as an immigrant by himself and worked for his uncle in Cleveland. So during the period when I'm losing myself here.
Are you Dr. Burning?
Yes.
Oh, I was supposed to tell you too, my God.
Okay.
You're supposed to call. Turn back on. I was telling the story about Herbert Dow and John Grebe, and the fact that Grebe had left his entire family it was a large family in Germany. So he took a leave of absence about 6 months after I went to the physics lab to Germany to visit his family and to arrange to bring them back to the United States. But in the meantime, he left me with the problem of measuring the Pacific heat of Dowtherm at Dowphenyl oxide at different temperature ranges. And to do that, I needed a couple of resistance thermometers, which before John left, we had ordered from Leeds and Northup. And Herbert Dow called me about a week after John had left for Germany and said, how are you coming along with the Pacific heat measurements? He was not interested in things like that. And I told him, well, we had ordered these thermometers, these resistance thermometers, and we hadn't heard from them in about 10 days. And Herbert Dow said, well, 10 days is much too long to wait for something like that. He said, you get on the phone and call them and find out when they're going to ship it. Believe it or not, this is the first time I had ever had an occasion to use a long-distance telephone. Remember, this was 1926. But I went to the Pershing Department and got permission to talk. I knew enough to do that, to talk to Leeds and Northup, and they gave me the number to call. I called the number, and when Herbert Dow called first thing next morning to find out what had happened, I was able to tell him, well, they were shipped and they were on the way and we'd have them soon. But he was that interested in everything that was going on.
That's amazing, because in an operation that size...
Yes, he'd have so much to do.
What kind of a person was Grebe to work for at the beginning when you started with him in the lab?
Very easy, very easy. He gave you all kinds of what I call accountable freedom, not just freedom to go do your time or waste or anything else, but what he called accountable freedom. And if you had that and you were working on something of interest to the Dow Chemical Company, even though it was for something which might be good 10, 20 years from now, he encouraged it. He just simply encouraged it, and he was enthusiastic, and he, in order to encourage people to do more of it, he originated what he called the idea card system. And everybody in the lab, he had, these cards were available, so everybody had the cards. And if you had an idea, no matter how wild it was, you filled in the card, you dated it, made it a record, and then, this is the most interesting thing, you posted it on the bulletin board, which he had made especially for this, for everybody to see, for everybody to make suggestions to help you out or to improve it or to do something with it. So this was his idea card system, and it's so characteristic of John Grebe that I took the time to mention it.
I had not heard about that before. That's interesting.
It's a very interesting thing, and I don't know of any place else that's ever been used either. It must have been, but this was my only contact with it.
Now, would he follow up on those two? And would he, when you didn't give them to him to post, you posted them directly on the board?
Yes. Anybody who had an idea posted them directly on the board.
Right.
Without giving them to him, he would look at the board every day and see what was new and what was going on. And he always encouraged ideas. And if you were discouraged and you couldn't make it work, he had 16 more ideas of how to make it work. So he was so easy to talk to and so enthusiastic about everything that everybody talked with him, everybody liked him. Everybody in the lab liked him. I guess we had competition in some of the other labs that were, wasn't that quite that way. But
I was going to ask you whether you had any kind of regular meetings, but to discuss what you were doing within the lab.
We did have regular meetings. We had once a month. We had what he called a seminar, which where he encouraged everybody to come. Herbert Dow, Willard Dow used to come to some of these meetings when we review in writing. These were written reports at that time. And then every other month we'd have oral reports, which were just exclusively for the lab personnel themselves, and they could exchange ideas and talk about them or make fun of them or anything else they wanted to. But the formal meetings every other month were for the plant production people and for other research heads, and for Dr. Dow and Willard Dow, if they wanted to come. But we did have these formal meetings as well as the informal ones.
Now, very early, you did some work in, I also have a note here that you worked on the distillation of tetraethyl lead. You did one of those for Britton?
Dr. Britton in the organic lab, he also bored me before John had bored me. He bored me for a few days to help him out on the distillation of tetraethyl lead, which he was doing some work for DuPont at that time. And I was there busy at the desk running a distillation of tetraethyl lead and some other things, which Dr. Britton had told me how to do and what to do and how to set it up and everything. But I was sitting right close to the distillation flask, and Dr. Britton came along and he said, well, this material has been known to explode, so maybe you better stand back a few feet. And he hadn't walked 15 feet away when, boom, the whole thing went up. Everybody in the lab had to evacuate. Nobody was hurt. But the white fumes filled the lab, and of course it was tetraethyl lead, and it was poisonous. Everybody got out of the lab, and they had to stay out for a half a day. And that was my the next day. Dr. Britton sent me back to the main lab. That was my experience as an organic chemist.
Was this a common way of doing that? They would come into the main lab and pull people out?
I've learned much later that was a very common way. I did not realize it at the time.
And this is how they determined which ones they wanted to move into their
Exactly. It was rather a good system.
Very early, when did you start working on the bromine? I guess that was a little later, wasn't it?
A little later, but not very much. There weren't many in the lab. There were probably a dozen in the lab by that time. See what a bromine.
Can you tell me something about your experiences with that?
Yes. John Grebe came to me and said that the DuPont were very much interested in large quantities of bromine, much larger than we already at Dow had already agreed to double the number of brine wells they had in order to make bromine for tetraethyl lead, or for ethylene dibromide in use with ethyl fluid. But at the same time, they knew, DuPont knew, and Dow knew too, that they couldn't possibly get this much bromine from the brine wells. It was too expensive to do it that way. So DuPont was interested in making bromine from seawater, and they had already devised a system which used aniline. And they added aniline, they freed the bromine, added aniline to make tribromaniline, which was an insoluble material, filtered it, and either used that then, they planned to either use that as an additive rather than the ethylene dibromide, or else to free the bromine and then make ethylene dibromide from it. And they had outfitted a ship, which they called the Good Ship Ethel, and taken it out into the ocean. But it was expensive, and the tribromaniline was difficult to filter, and the losses were very high, so it was a failure. And so then they came to Dow and said, how about making bromine? And H.H. Dow got interested right away quick in making it from seawater. So the group who were, Barstow's group in the Dow Chemical Company, were responsible for the bromine work. So they were working on the bromine, but they couldn't, for some reason or other, they weren't able to free the bromine in the ocean. It just didn't work. They got a little bromine and then it disappeared. And so John Grebe came to me and said, well, look, what they're forgetting about is that there's a little bit of alkalinity in the ocean. There's probably sodium carbonate or bicarbonate, and you have to acidify this first before you can possibly free the bromine. Otherwise, it'll make sodium bromate, and you'll never even see it, and it won't be volatile. So he said, run a titration curve on ocean water and see what it looks like. And I did, and sure enough, there was at a pH of about 7 or 6, maybe it was, and then you titrated it with acid, with 10th acid, and then it went up down to 3. So John said, acidify it to a pH of 3 and then chlorinate it and see if you can free the bromine. Well, sure enough, first you get a flash of iodine, and then you get the bromine color. And that's all there was to it, and that was John's invention. And then the method of controlling the acidity and the method of then controlling the chlorination, too, to control so you get good efficiency. But that was the contribution of the physics lab to the seawater bromine process.
And this is what those controls then are what you use for your master's thesis?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Actually, my master's thesis was on the theory of automatic control,
okay,
starting with damping control and anticipatory control and all those sorts of things. But that's also was Grebe's interest at that time was very much, and Herbert Dow's interest was very much in that.
How long did that take to work out? What period of time?
Maybe 3 months.
3 months.
Our contribution. And then, of course, after the plant was built, the physics lab people went down and worked in the plant, actually put in the instruments and the controls and stayed there to operate it. And then a little later in the seawater bromine process, a chap by the name of George Hooker came up with the conventional method of first you blow the bromine out with air, and then you react in another tower, absorption tower, you react it with sodium carbonate, to make sodium bromide. And then you free the sodium bromide with more chlorine to get get the bromine concentrated. Well, George Hooker came up with the idea of he was a physics labber. He came up with the idea of burning sulfur to SO2, introducing that into the air, the blowing out air, with a very dilute bromine, making a combination of sulfuric acid, which you could then recycle back into to acidify the seawater, and HBr, which none of which were volatile, and this would drop out and would save one whole step in the process of regenerating the sodium bromate. So this was being done, and this also was a physics lab proposition, and we had physics lab people down when they built that plant and started. That was probably 2 or 3 years later, after the plant was a success.
Did you make any trips to the plant yourself?
Yes, I spent, in Wilmington, North Carolina, I spent maybe a month down there altogether, different times, checking the automatic controls.
When was that plant built then? What year was that?
Just for a wild guess, I'd say 1932 or 3.
Okay.
Plus or minus about 3 years.
What was your next project after that?
Maybe sodium for an electrical conductor. Oh, first of all, we used the Dow Chemical Company used sodium as a reducing agent in the production of indigo dye, and the sodium was manufactured somewhere in the Niagara Falls by an outside company, and Dow bought it. But the price went up and up and up to where Herbert Dow decided that we could make it ourselves more economically than we could do it, than we could buy it. So he had, we designed and built a sodium cell using salt as a thing. But the difference was, there's always a problem with a high temperature sodium cell, that the sodium is freed at the cathode, I think it was a cathode, and then it redissolves or backs up into the salt, mixture of salt, and you never can skim it off or get it all out. So John's idea was to have the cathode just touch the bath so that the temperature at the point where the sodium was produced was above the boiling point of sodium. So then we built a condenser above it, and theoretically at least, and we did, we made maybe 100 pounds of sodium altogether that way. But in the meantime, this company that was furnishing sodium heard about all of this, and they lowered the price down to where it was no longer economical. Well, then the next problem was, this got Herbert Dow interested, and so he thought, well, why use all this good copper for electrical conductors when the ocean is full of ocean is full of sodium? So we worked on a high amperage sodium conductor, and the DC current was produced on one side of the river, and then across the bridge, the electrical line for the sodium cell, for the chlorine cells that were operating on the other side of the river. And so he said, well, why don't we just take a 2-inch pipe and fill it with sodium and put it across the bridge and use this as an electrical conductor for the high amperage current. Mm. And so we did, and we had all kinds of trouble with it and all kinds of problems. But nevertheless, we filled it about 3,000 feet of 2-inch pipe and mounted it and filled it up and used that as an electrical conductor. And of course, the problems were many. Mostly it was just getting good contact all the way through and filling the pipes. We were given scrap, well, they weren't really scrap. They were good 3- and 2-inch pipes, but they'd been used for brine before, and they were rusted a little bit, and the water underneath, the brine underneath, and so when we tried to fill the darn things with sodium, the sodium went woof, and it blew out, and we tried to fill 40-foot lengths at a time. And then we had, of course, the problem of connecting each 40-foot length, and that was not easy either. But nevertheless, we were able to dry the pipes, and we were able to make it and get it installed, and it operated, I guess, for about 2 or 3 years. And this was written up in an Electrochemical Society paper.
What did you turn your attention to after that? I have a number of things here that you worked on in this. Well, let me back up a moment. You became assistant director in 1930. How did that appointment occur?
Well, I guess it just grew like Topsy. It just grew because I was the first one there, and John Lackme, we got along fine, and I was a very good listener. That's probably why John liked me the most, because I could listen to his ideas and not get too impatient. Sometimes I did get impatient, but yeah, I didn't show it. But that was the team we had. Then it was Grevy and Boundy.
I have a list here of some other projects, and I'm not sure of the order, but maybe we could just talk about them briefly. Were you involved in making acetylene?
Only as an assistant lab director. Dr. Matheson was the one who was primarily interested in making acetylene. And Larry Amos was interested in trying to get the data necessary to decide whether acetylene or ethylene would be the future thing. And it's interesting, too, that now, after all these years, it begins to look to me as if about the time the oil gets to be either very expensive or it peters out entirely, and then coal comes along and the same thing happens to it, or even before that happens, when you have to grow trees or use coke, then maybe the acetylene method is going to be the way to do it. And maybe the way to do it would be to use energy from the sun to make calcium carbide, ship calcium carbide anywhere in the world you need to, and use that then, use the acetylene to make all the basic chemicals. And this could well be something that would happen, sometime in the far distant future. But it's at least a practical method of substituting natural trees and the charcoal from natural trees or coal for petroleum. And this is going to have to happen someday.
Mm-hmm. You instituted a training program for people in the Dow Well Service. It was a technical training program.
Mm-hmm. It was a technical training program.
Did you start that? There were courses given, and as I understand.
Yes, Larry Amos had a lot to do with the courses. I guess I just was, as John's assistant, was there and knew about it and helped out. But I don't think that I originated the idea.
Okay.
But Dow Well was one of the things that the physics lab did early that turned out to be very, very important.
Were you involved at all in that, or is that?
I was involved in it, but primarily as assistant director. It's interesting, about the time I became assistant director, Dr. Vesey, who was working summers, and really Dr. Vesey had assumed that's the way you got authority in the Dow Chemical Company, was to just assume it. But at that time, so he had sort of, as far as I'm concerned, he had assumed responsibility for the director of being director of research. But he called me in one day and said, "Well, now that you're assistant, one thing you need to be very careful of is not to discourage other people to have patents. That you should not get patents yourself. You should encourage other people, even if you give them your idea." So this is what I started to do about the time I became assistant director. I grew to the point where I just said, "Well, look, let's try this or let's try that." And that John had done that before, too. He didn't worry about patents. He got quite a few. I had 15 before this happened, and then after that I didn't get involved in patents, except where it was just clearly something that I was involved in and somebody else wanted my name on it or something like that.
Do you have a list of those patents anywhere?
I do, but not here, and not in Midland either.
Maybe
the Dow Chemical Company would have a list. I must have it somewhere, but
maybe somewhere in the if you're back in Midland, if you think of it, if you could send me a list of patents and papers, publications.
I had about 15 publications and 15 patents. That's about the way it was.
Okay. If you could, if you have that list available, well, I'll see if I do.
Okay.
Did you, when you became assistant director then, did that mean that you were removed, being more and more removed from actual participation in the laboratory work?
Yes, it meant that. But at the same time, it was such a small laboratory that I still did laboratory work as long as I was an assistant until I was transferred into the starting program. Mm-hmm. I still did research work.
Okay.
Quite a bit.
With Larry Amos, use of ferric chloride is for treating water, municipal waters and sewage.
Mm-hmm.
Did you work on that with him?
Yes, I worked on that with him.
What was behind that?
Behind that was the primary reason for it was that chlorine is a hard material, a difficult material to store, and yet you want your chlorine cells to operate continuously and uniformly 24 hours a day. So if you don't have any other use for the chlorine, let's just make ferric chloride, because this, you just bubble the chlorine through a solution with iron shavings and you make ferric chloride. So then what do you do with ferric chloride? And this was one of the things. And the other thing that Sacer developed was a photographic etching, which didn't use very much, but it was a good use for it. But the municipal precipitant, coagulant, I guess is what I should say, was a big use for many years.
Was that used just in Midland, or was it used?
No, it was used in Detroit, I'm sure, and it was used in Toronto because Larry and I both made a trip to Toronto way early in the development work to help them get set up to use ferric chloride, and they did use ferric chloride in Toronto at the municipal waste disposal plant.
Could you also tell me something about Sylvia Stasser? You'd mentioned something about her briefly before we started taping, but could you tell me something about when she joined the lab and some of her early work there?
She joined the lab, again, I think it was 1930, but it was plus or minus a year.
Mm-hmm.
And she joined the lab because her husband was hired, and he would not come unless she was offered a job. And so they found a place for her, and John was very happy to have her in the physics lab. And the physics lab also, this is a peculiar reason for hiring somebody, but the physics lab was outside the fence. It was right next to the main office, and we'd had no restroom facilities for females in the laboratory, so she and the secretaries went to the main office where they had facilities. So that was another reason that had to be taken, another thing that had to be taken care of.
Were you involved in, did you talk to her at all before she was hired, or?
I don't remember that I talked to her before. I think we just, John talked to me and we agreed we wanted her and we had her, and we had her. I don't remember either one of us having a formal interview with her. We must have had, but I don't remember it.
Now, you said she was the first.
She was the first female chemist in Dow Research anywhere, and certainly the first PhD. And in our lab, she was the scientist of the group.
I see.
And everybody went to her to try out their ideas and to get help.
And what kind of work was she? What kind of work did she do when she?
She did work. She took over my work on the physical properties of Dow Therm and the heat stability of Dow Therm. That probably was one of our first jobs, this using ferric chloride as a photographic etchant was another one, and then the purity of styrene monomer. She was very, very much responsible for the total work on the actual making pure styrene monomer, and how do you do it, and inhibitors that you can use for the distillation and for storage and all that sort of a thing. I'll show you. Oh, I have to take this off.
Okay, yes.
One of the really difficult problems with styrene, polystyrene, was the fact that it etched and got foggy on the surface. And she is the one who discovered that it was a remaining monomer and low volatile material in general. If you removed all of that down to 1%, then the material was commercially practical and a good polymer. And at least one of the stories is that DuPont did a great deal of research work on this, and they gave it up because it just simply wouldn't last. Well, here is a sample that's 50 years old, and that is her work. She was responsible for that.
Did she make those for a number of people?
Oh, she made them for... You can see what she did. She would burn out electric light bulbs, and she filled them with monomer.
Right.
And put in what anything... We made a lot of them with magnesium crystals because they were so beautiful. But anything anybody wanted to preserve, they put it in there like that. She made them with the hundreds for everybody in the lab and a lot of people in the company. And then we used it for giveaways, too.
Yeah. That's the first one I've seen that anybody's told me about. That's excellent. You may have one of the few that remain from that period.
I suspect this is one of the very few that remain. In fact, I don't have many papers, but a lot of junk like this I have collected.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Just as an aside, we received a sample of the first sulfur-free tire. It's a slice of one of the early sulfur-free tires that was made.
Yeah.
So somebody had put away for 50 years or how, I guess it was 1924 when that was done. So, well, that's certainly worth preserving.
Well, let's see. Stacer, she stayed with the polystyrene purity and polystyrene program. And that probably was her biggest single contribution, although she made many other contributions, including helping out everybody else. But she did quite a bit of work on Dowell. She did a lot of work on the early work on Dowell, different inhibitors to use and that sort of a thing. I don't remember what else. She after about 10 years, she retired to raise a family.
I see. But she did come back.
She came back to write the book on be the editor. If she hadn't have done that, we never would have.
You want me to do that?
We never had that book published if she had not been willing to come back and really be the editor.
That's interesting. I was just talking to Ray about that book this morning, and he told me a little bit about how that originated. We're getting a little ahead here, but why don't we continue with the book at least now. He said that he had put out 5 pamphlets, technical bulletins on styrene, that Willard Dow was on the editorial board of ACS Monographs. And he took that to the editorial board, and that became the nucleus of the book. Now, how did you get involved? Did Willard Dow come to you about that?
Yeah, I talked to... I'll tell you what I remember about it. I was in Willard Dow's office. We talked at least once a month. I just reviewed everything that was going on. But Willard Dow said to me, in effect, words like this: "We have given during the war to all of our good competitors all the information we have on styrene, how to make it, how to purify it, everything, even a great deal of information on making the polymer from it because of the rubber program." And he said, "Now let's just make this a real race, a real competitive race. Let's publish everything we know about it. Let's let everybody have it, and we'll see who wins." And I think it was one of the smart things he did because it didn't hurt Dow Chemical Company at all. The competition was good for them.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And now Ray Boyer probably, he had also talked with Willard Dow. But Willard was the one who gave us permission to publish it and was the one who actually encouraged us. And he Willard Dow loved competition. He just loved competition, any competition by anybody. He often had two pilot plants in two different laboratories making the same thing by a slightly different process just to get the competition. So this was a natural thing for him to say.
And who was responsible for getting Sylvia back into to service?
Ray Boyer.
Ray was the one who got her in.
I agreed, but Ray Boyer is the one who was responsible.
Well, let's come back then to, since we're talking about the styrene book, let's come back to when the physics lab first started getting into styrene. When did you first start working on styrene?
The organic lab under Dr. E.C. Britton had done just a small amount of work on making styrene from pure ethyl alcohol, and anyhow they made I can't think of the proper name for it, but anyhow it's a reaction product of benzene and alcohol, so that you get an alcohol and then you dehydrate that to make the styrene. And this is a classical organic method of making styrene monomer, and they had made a little bit that way, and they had got the same crazing that the Bond had got. Well, Bobby Dreisbach, who worked in the physics lab, he knew that Dow also Dow had benzene, because they were making phenol from benzene, and he knew that we were just building a large ethylene plant and we're going to have excess ethylene. So what Bobby did was to make sort of a crossword puzzle in which on one axis he put down all the things that might react with ethylene, and benzene was one of them, and then on the other side he had ethylene, so that then in each compartment he filled in what might happen and what would it be and would it be commercial. And one of the things he ended up with was ethyl benzene, and then that dehydrogenated to styrene. And so that's how styrene got started. Bobby made this what we call the crossword puzzle and decided that this was the way to do it, and that making ethyl benzene and dehydrating ethyl benzene was the cheapest way to make it. So he is the one in Dow who really got us started. And Stacer is the one who was a scientist and made it possible.
Then I guess it was, I want to keep trying to keep the date straight, but it was in 1942 when you were asked to head the expansion of the styrene production.
This is also plus or minus a year, but about 1939, Willard Dow could see the war coming, and he didn't like to actually, I shouldn't say delegated, because he did delegate responsibility, but he didn't like to have a lot of vice presidents, let's say it that way. So he picked three of us, and two of us, Dr. Hebbard and myself, were from the physics lab, and Dr. Kendall, who was at that time running the ethylene plant, and made us assistants to the president. Not assistant presidents, but assistants to the president. And then he would delegate to us different responsibilities. And once he had delegated it to you, you were on your own and you could just go do it. And you had accountable freedom again.
Well, what was the state of styrene production in 1942 within the company?
Let's go back to 1937. 1937, Dow had built the first, what we called at that time, a commercial plant. And we were making the monomer, making a good grade pure monomer. And then we used what we called the can method for making the polymer. Mm-hmm. And this was just simply putting in a 10-gallon can and carefully controlling the temperature over a period of time. But then all we did was to grind up the polystyrene and sell it to either Monsanto or Bakelite. And that continued up, that continued until the war started. And I guess it was 1942 before the river program really was initiated. I think that's right.
What was your responsibility? What did Dowd give you as your...
As an assistant to the president, I was told, it's your responsibility. Go do it. That was it. And we had at one time a plant in Gary, Indiana that finally was not needed and wasn't actually even started. But we had Gary, Indiana, we had Texas, we had California, Los Angeles, and Port Huron, across the river from Port Huron.
Sarnia.
And I had the responsibility for getting those all built and initial operation, not the operation after they started. But the training of the personnel, we had not only did we have all of these plants of our own, but we had also a group of people from Coppers and a group of people from Monsanto who came in for training in the only commercial plant that was being operated in the United States in Midland, Michigan. Oh, we were building another plant in Michigan, too, at that time. So we had these five different plants. And once a month, I made a trip around, a circuit around each one of them. Mm.
Did you select those sites, or were those sites already...
Those sites were selected primarily by Rubber Reserve Company in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was a well-run, very well-run government organization. They did a magnificent job.
And then Dow was under contract to build the plants that they determined.
Yes.
Who was your contact in Washington?
John Livingston. John Livingston, and then Brad Dewey right after that, Bradley Dewey. One was, I think they both of them at one time or another were presidents of Rubber Reserve. But Livingston is the one who really, he was from Monsanto. And he's the one who did the legwork. Mm-hmm. Bradley Dewey stayed primarily in Washington.
How did you set out when you were given this responsibility it was really quite an undertaking to get five, I counted what, one... Four different places, five different places operational, constructed and operational.
I don't know how I did it, to tell you the truth. But I had an awful lot of good help, just darn good help. It's amazing, and it would be a good study in psychology for somebody today. We had 60 people in training at one time in Midland. Part of these, most of them were Dow. But by that time, the technical personnel was pretty well at the bottom of the barrel. We had our own magnesium problems, and most of these kids were just an average group of technical employees. But there were 60 of them altogether. And to study them and what happened to them, and the responsibility they were given all at once, a lot of responsibility, and the fact that out of that 60 came at least two presidents of companies, two or three or four vice presidents of companies, a lot of lab directors. It's just unbelievable that 60 people could contribute so much. Mm-hmm. after the war. And I think it was primarily that they were given an awful lot of, at a very early age, they were pointed in the right direction and given a lot of accountable freedom.
Mm-hmm. Did you establish an organizational framework, people that worked under you and doing this?
I had one assistant, Mitchell, J.E. Mitchell, who was responsible for the training of all of the personnel, and also along with the training, the writing of the manuals for operation of the plants. And he had a manual for the automatic controls, and another instrumentation, automatic controls, another manual for ethylene production, and another manual for ethylbenzene production and another manual for styrene production. And this was a terrific load off my mind. And then, except for the Midland plant, it's a New England, a Boston company was given responsibility for the design and construction. I can't think of the name right now, but it's well known. They're still in existence, and this was a very, very good. And they were able to do a great deal of what would sound like a very difficult job, but they were able to do that. And we sent engineers from our own engineering department out to Boston. Stone and Webster, that's the name.
Yes.
But we sent them out there, and they were in-house and helped in the design. But then Stone and Webster did do the design and the construction. And we intentionally built the plant in, well, Texas is a good example. It was the largest plant. But we built it in four different units. Each unit small enough that a manager could understand and see all the piping, and if anything went wrong, you only lost one-fourth of your plant rather than the whole plant. Today, I'm sure the logical thing to do would be to build one huge plant, one huge ethylene plant, so on and so forth, right down the line. But we didn't. We built four with their own inventories, each one a separate unit, so that if sabotage or fire or anything shut down one unit, you'd have a chance to keep the others running, and also because it was easier for an operator to understand that kind of a plant.
Mm-hmm. How did you select the personnel that were running these plants? Where did they come from?
They were this 60 people that we hired. Most of them were just new graduates out of school. Out of that 60 people we hired, Only three had any production experience whatever. So you can see what a responsibility these kids were given all at once. They were just pointed in the right direction, but the plants were designed with the fact in mind that this is the kind of people who would be running the plants, and you shouldn't make them complicated.
Did these 60 all come in at the same time then?
They came in all in...
In the
same year.
Yeah.
Yes. And they were all in Midland at one time. And Mitchell, J.E. Mitchell, was responsible for the training and for the writing, as I mentioned.
Do you know if any of those manuals still exist? Do you know if any of those training manuals still exist? Would the company have any?
I'm sure they do. And that would be very interesting. And I don't know where to tell you to go to get them. I'll leave it up to me to try to find them. I know at least where to start.
Okay, that would be great, because they certainly would be...
It would be very good. I'd like to see them again,
yes.
Too.
To take people like that and to train them to run plants of that kind in really short order.
Yes.
Time was of the essence. And
those plants started up on schedule. They started up without a single last-time accident. It's just unbelievable.
How long was that? You started in 1942. When were they in production?
They were operating in less than 2 years.
Wow.
Operating at design capacity in less than 2 years. That alone today would be an impossible job. But at that time, it didn't seem to be. There's so much more red tape today. I don't know whether I could stand it or not. Government red tape, ecology red tape, everything.
Well, that's, I guess, I think everything is much more complicated
today
than
it
was then.
It is.
Certainly that.
And while we didn't have any accidents, neither did we consider the safety like we do today.
Mm-hmm.
Here again, I think it was primarily if a youngster understands what is possible and what has to be done safely, he'll even operate a hazardous equipment in a safe way.
Now, when the war ended, this changed things drastically in terms of what the need was for styrene.
Yes.
I drifted right back into plastics. And still, as an assistant to Willard Dow, I organized the plastics department. And here again, he gave me all kinds of accountable freedom. When we moved out and built a new warehouse, and in the warehouse we built our PTS, our plastics, this was Bill Goggins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was in the same place, the same story, and all the office building, everything responsible for plastics was about 2 miles away from the main office. And one time somebody asked me, well, how much autonomy do you have to have in order to have a separate department and not be interfered with too much with the president and the vice president and all that? And I said, oh, about 2.5 miles.
That's excellent.
But it worked. It worked very well, and we were left alone pretty much. And to some extent, the same system then was used by the Dow Chemical Company to organize the chemical department and other departments of the company.
I wanted to talk a little more about that, how you organized that, but before I forget, there's one minor thing that I read about. During the war, Matheson gave a talk on the possibilities of splitting the atom. And followed by a visit by the Secret Service.
Yes, he gave him a talk to the American Chemical Society, in which he pointed out the possibility of a nuclear bomb. And just one day later, I think, or maybe 2 days later, we had the FBI and asking how in the world did Matheson know about. Well, he knew about it because he was a darn good physicist.
Where did he get his information that he put that talk together? Was
he himself? He couldn't have got it anywhere else, but just, well, I shouldn't say in no place else. He got it. He went to school. He got his doctorate degree in the University of Michigan.
Okay.
And went to school in Canada, in London, Canada. I don't remember the name of the university. But he got the idea himself and what he knew about it and what he had read about it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he had read what the Germans had published quite a bit about the fact that it was possible. German scientists, not the German government.
Right. That was an interesting how quickly the government managed to find out about it.
I should say so.
The main thing I wanted to talk about, though, was your trip to Germany to investigate their synthetic war program. Could you tell me something about how that came about and
this
your experiences
was there? A part of the army was under the supervision of the army, and it was called the Technical Service Corps. And the idea was, and it was organized primarily to follow the troops into Germany, right behind the troops, even before peace was declared, and find out what their industry was like, and what they made, and how they made it, and bring us back to the United States. In other words, bring back all the technology you could find and get. Mm-hmm. And my own part of it was the synthetic rubber program, of course, and what they did. That involved styrene, of course, and polystyrene, that sort of thing.
Now, who were the others in your group?
Dr. Bill Goggin and Dr. Hirschkin. Hirschkin was from California, Pittsburgh plant, Pittsburgh laboratory.
Okay, now Bill told me that they were looking at the plastics industry, but he didn't pay much attention to rubber because there was, I guess it was your group that was looking at at rubber, so they tried to separate the
That's right.
separate the two.
And we did get, when we got to Germany, we got all mixed up anyway, but he's right, that was it. And I don't remember who else, Leonard Hashey from Tennessee Eastman was one of the rubber, synthetic rubber people. And I don't remember whether there was anybody else or not. I don't remember that there was. But he and I were. Oh, then the In general, this didn't happen all the time, but in general, the English went along. They also had a group, and we went together. So we had English counterparts. And we were called, as Bill probably told you, we were called capon colonels.
No.
we were given a sort of a synthetic colonel rating in the Army. If you were captured by the enemy, this would give you the status of being a colonel and being an Army officer rather than a civilian or something like, or being a spy.
I see. How were you selected to go on this team? Was it come out of Washington?
Or? Came out of Washington. And I guess I don't know any more about it than that it came out of Washington in a letter to Dr. Putnam.
And when did you leave for Europe?
I was in Washington waiting for more than a month, about 6 weeks. So, and peace was declared the Japanese war was still continuing, but the German war was over before I got there. So it was that right in that period. It was probably May when I got there.
Okay, May 45.
And we flew across Pan American.
Or a commercial plane.
Well, it was Pan American, but they were entirely Army.
I see.
And we had the old bucket seats you sat in.
And where did you start then? When you got, did you go to England first?
England first, and we were pretty thoroughly briefed there. And then we flew into Leipzig one time, and I think Frankfurt or someplace like that the second time. And then the Army, we were under the supervision of the Army, and they furnished a jeep and a driver.
Were you there then in Germany?
I was there about 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
Maybe 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about some of your experiences, where you went, what you saw?
Well, the most interesting experience was in the Leipzig area, because that's where the Russians came in, and our contacts with the Russians and how they acted even at that time was probably the most significant experience we had. On one occasion, and I forget the name of the river, but it was a river that divided the two, the Russian territory from U.S. and England and France territory. But anyway, we wanted to visit a plant which was ethyl cellulose, or at least it was a cellulose plant across the river into the Russian territory. And so we stopped at the Russian gates and asked them and got permission. They finally gave us permission to go in, and we went in, and I think Bill Dawkins was along with me that time. But anyway, they loaded us in a jeep and we took us to the plant, and we just had started to interview the manager of the plant when one of the group that came with us, I don't remember who it was, pulled out his notebook and started to write down the notes. And the Russians said, "This is it. Get in your jeep and go home." So we got in the jeep and went home. It was all right to listen, but you don't take any notes.
Were you generally accompanied by soldiers when you went into these areas?
Only a driver.
Only a
driver who would be a private.
And where did you stay? Did the Army provide you with...
Yes, the Army told us where to go, and usually it was a private home. A private home that the Army had taken over, and the Army had used for their officers or people, and they still were. In many cases, we had Army officers there at the same time we were. But that's where we stayed. We were given rooms.
And how did you find the Germans that you interviewed? Were they cooperative?
Very friendly, very willing to tell anything that they knew. I guess they felt that it was to their benefit to do that. And one of the ones we interviewed in Frankfurt, I think it was. Anyway, that doesn't matter. But he had worked for Dewey and Army in this country and had gone to Germany and joined the Nazis. But he was also willing to talk, and of course he could speak. Everybody we talked to practically could speak good English, reasonably good English.
And did you speak German?
Only a little, a very little. I could read German pretty well, but I couldn't speak it.
Did you have any surprises? Things
no,
they had been doing that.
No, a couple of times I got very nervous because I was in the middle of a plant all by myself, and nothing but the German workmen around me, and I kept wondering, well, what are they going to do to me? But they didn't do anything.
Were you wearing a uniform?
So it was just
Were you wearing a uniform? So that
yes, I was wearing a. We were permitted. We couldn't carry arms, but we were permitted to wear a uniform. And we didn't have any side bands or anything like that to show we were colonels or anything.
How much damage had there been done to the plant?
That's a good question. Two ways to look at it. In Leipzig, where the Air Corps was in at the same time we were there, and they were establishing the damage and how accurate there were. And this is primarily information I got from them, not what I saw myself, although I did see a little of it. But they said they were able to be sure that they wouldn't hit anything more than three miles away, and that it just went from the concentration where they tried to hit to 3 miles away. And that the concentration was just like that. And the other part of that, I forgot about this, in Ludwigshafen, which was one of the big IG plants, right. We noticed that one whole section of the plant was just completely detonated. It was gone. And so we asked them, the Americans must have been, or somebody must have been great efficiency for bombing. And they said, no, this was an accident they had. They had a tank car of butadiene and established a leak, and it leaked over this whole area of the plant, and then it blew up. And that had done more damage than all the American bombs. At least in that area it had, I should have said.
That's interesting. What could you assess about their styrene production? Let's say make a comparison to what Dow was doing, what was happening in this country. What were the Germans, how did the Germans compare?
Styrene, which was my primary responsibility. It was amazing to me that two companies starting out is true with at least some basic information on what each was doing, but nevertheless, from that time on, they had grown independently entirely, how completely the same two processes could have been. It was just remarkable. They were the same processes. We used different catalysts. That's another interesting thing about research. The Dow Chemical Company, was responsible through Rubber Reserve, for trying to find a better catalyst for making styrene, dehydrating styrene. And Shell and the oil companies were responsible for developing one for butadiene. Well, it just so happened in our research, Dow developed the best catalyst for butadiene, and Shell Chemical Company developed the best catalyst for styrene. So here was research aimed at different objectives and turning out to be just diametrically opposite. And I think even to this day, those same catalysts are being used for those two things. They may have been modified a bit, but I think primarily they're the same catalyst.
So you didn't really have any information that you could bring back that would have helped Dow Chemical, let's say?
Very little, either by Hirschgen or Gongen or myself. In fact, my own wild guess on the total effort of everybody who was sent over there was that there was very little that was extremely valuable.
Did you write a report? The Goggin Group, of course, has this.
I wrote a report. Leonard Hashey and I wrote a combined report. And there again, I don't have it, but the company must. Washington, D.C. must.
Yes. No, it would be nice to get a hold of that report.
Yes, it would. Because it did tell you how to make salary, and while we didn't say so, it told how to make, how the Americans made salary, too.
It's interesting, just as an aside, because on Monday I was in north of Chicago talking to Ernst Vollweiler, who was president of Abbott Laboratories.
Oh, yeah.
And he had been in Europe at the same time investigating the pharmaceutical company.
Well, I'll be done.
So I've had three people on this trip who are all involved in that same
program. What was his name?
Ernst Vollweiler. He was president of the American Chemical Society in 1950.
Yeah, I don't think I met him over there. I don't recall.
But he may have been a little later. I don't know if he was there.
Two people who were investigating the food end of it and how the Germans were managed to eat and stay healthy, but they were different. They weren't pharmaceutical.
Yeah, he was looking specifically at the pharmaceutical.
I probably wouldn't have met them.
What I'd like to do now is come to that point after the war. You said you were still special assistant to the president after the styrene production stopped. And this is when you organized the technical sales group. I'm not quite sure about the titles that evolved through that occurred as this group evolved, and what your role was in that. And I'm interested in that organization.
My role, and actually I moved out to this warehouse we built, which had also the tech service and development and the warehouse, and right behind it was the polystyrene production, right essentially in the same building. Our flow was from the monomer right through into the warehouse. So my office was there, and other than that, and being assistant to Dow and being responsible for the plastics development, that is what he had given me as a responsible to do. That's about all there was. Then there was a head of a sales department. He was also in this same building and quite close to me. So we had production right behind us, and sales and TS&D and manager of the plastics department, all in this one building, one complex. Now, of course, we had to work then with Texas and the monomer production there and all these other things too, and all the other polymers and the Saran and the production of Saran and that sort of a thing. But it all was in this centralized in this one building.
Now, the Dow, he had given you the responsibility of seeing that the styrene plants got into operation. Now, when you came back from the European trip, did he give you these, did he change the focus of your work? How did he approach that with you?
Well, here again, I think, as I remembered, I assumed it. Now, I must have told him, and he must have agreed, mm-hmm. which is the same thing as him telling me to do it, I guess. But at Dow at that time, you could assume responsibility for practically anything. Mm-hmm. And as long as he knew about it and agreed, and you didn't make too many mistakes, you were okay.
Now, in your mind, were you looking at, here is Dow producing all of this styrene and now the need for it has disappeared. Were you looking at creating an additional need for that styrene and capability that...
Yes.
Is that how that whole program got started?
That's how the polystyrene program got started, was knowing that there'd be a large excess, a very large. Actually, it didn't turn out to be, because the synthetic rubber program went on and there's still a lot of synthetic rubber made. So it didn't turn out to be nearly the surplus overflow of styrene monomer that we had expected it would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you go about setting all of this up then? Can you describe some of the development that occurred, let's say, through time that you became research director? You headed plastic, I'm not sure I have the terms, the titles right here, but you headed plastic sales, was that the...
I headed the plastics department.
Plastics department, okay.
And actually, this it was a complicated sort of an arrangement, and the only thing that made it workable was the fact that I was his assistant too, and he had delegated, the president of the company had delegated this responsibility to me, because the head of plastic sales line responsibility was for the sales department, the main sales department, and the head of the sales department. So mine was a heavy dotted line, and the same thing with research. Research was done all around the company, and for plastics, I had a heavy dotted line to all of this research, and so on. TS&D and sales. Well, TS&D was pretty much Goggin, and he was part of our organization right there, and of course that made a beautiful tie-in with research. No matter where it was, we had the in-between the customer and the research.
Yeah, I found this paper that you and Goggin wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Which does, there was a symposium, an ACS symposium.
I remember now. I didn't remember.
This was 1948.
And as I remember, too, there was something said in this paper which didn't help when we had our lawsuit on polystyrene with McCurdy.
Oh, really? Can you tell me something about that?
Only that... well... It's pretty hard to say anything. McCurdy, who was the one who distributed so much of Dow's technology everywhere, left Dow in 1958 when the Dow Chemical Company had a bad recession and everybody was supposed to reduce their force 10%, their help 10%, and McCurdy felt that he had, incidentally, McCurdy was my brother-in-law.
Oh, really?
But McCurdy felt that he had a good organization. He felt he'd kept it trim. He had laid off people who weren't doing the work right. So he said to the company, I'm the first one. Just take me and keep the rest of them. So he left the company, and that's why he left and how he left. I don't think it really hurt Dow. I think competition was good for them.
Mm-hmm. You became research director.
I was vice president before. That became research director.
1950, I guess.
That's about right.
I'm not sure I want to ask the next question. How did you see managing research? You had come up through doing a number of things yourself. What was your approach to managing research at Dow in 1950 when you were given, and how did that title come into being? How did you acquire that position?
See, Willard Dow had died, or he was killed in the plane accident, and Lee Doan had taken over, and Lee Doan simply felt that he was not trained and capable of directing research, as Willard Dow had been before him. So he is the one who decided that we needed a director of research, and he is the one who appointed me as director of research.
Yeah.
Now, how I managed it, I think pretty much I felt that the director of research should be responsible primarily for the record keeping and the research accounting, and I went in pretty heavily for research accounting and the ability to say, well, this lab was effective and productive to this extent, and the return on investment in this lab was such and such, and that lab was such and such. But other than that, and we had this all charted. In my office, we had a chart room with one person responsible for keeping the whole thing up to date and bringing in all the records from everywhere, so that we had lost time accidents, patent applications, issued patents, everything charted that you could think of, including return on investment on each lab and return on investment of total research. And then the amount of process and product improvement research, the amount, the percent of basic, what we call basic and pure research, what's one other in there? There's basic and process and product improvement and customer research. Application research, I guess, is a better name for it. But I rather felt that it was my responsibility to know what was going on everywhere, to get around personally and visit each one of these labs at least twice a year and talk to the people there. And generally speaking, this was also part of the chart room, but I had pictures so that if I was to visit the Western Laboratory, I had a folder which showed the picture of everybody working in that laboratory. It just helped me to get their names straight and know who they were a little better than I would have if I had walked in cold. So that sort of a thing, visiting first that much, but then keeping really good records of what was happening in every lab and the company as a whole, and having this so that if anybody criticized research, I could at least bring them into the chart room and set them down and show what was going on and why. And then we had a research advisory committee that met every 6 months, and they were the heads of every laboratory in the company. And I think at that time we had about 30. And they would come in and we would review in the chart room everything that was going on, everything. We didn't hold anything back. Whatever the lab showed on the charts, we showed them what it was. And one of the interesting things, the most profitable laboratories, generally speaking, this was not always true, were the little labs that were lost out in the production plants, right out in the middle of production, with the worst facilities, and where you would have said they just never would have done it. But they were the ones who were the most profitable.
That's amazing. Is there anything you would attribute that to, that their success under close, an ideal condition?
Closeness to production.
Rather than closeness. They see the problems better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They see the problems and they work on the immediate problems. And it's, what I said is perhaps a little misleading, because while their production and their profit was better than the other labs, still, the other labs were doing work which would show up in 10 or 15 or 20 years, and these production labs were doing it now. So our method of record keeping, we tried to new products was another thing we studied, and we took them for 10 years, and then we said if they aren't profitable in 10 years, we drop them off. We don't credit them for research any longer than 10 years. But that sort of a thing was probably about all that we could do.
Did you still give your people this freedom with accountability that allow them to work pretty much on their own?
We tried to. In effect, what I did was to give it to the lab director, and then the lab director was... One of the things that might be interesting, and this also in my book somewhere, but in trying to study what was different about the physics lab and why was it so successful at that time and could it be reproduced again now, one of my conclusions has been that we had as a head of our lab, the manager of our laboratory, or director of whatever you want, wish to call him, the most the most technically uninhibited, the most enthusiastic, and the most, I can't think of the word. Unconventional is another word for it. An unconventional man as a head of it. Where usually those people work down in the lab, the creative people work in the lab, and you have a business manager who looks over them and tries to steer them, and maybe that's one of the reasons why this was so successful. Grebe was the manager, and he did manage the lab, and he managed it as a very enthusiastic, very unconventional individual. And maybe that's one of the reasons why it was so successful. Today, as you know, practically every laboratory is managed by a good businessman, and you hope to get your creativity down in the lab somewhere. I'm not so sure that that's the way you get it.
Well, Ray, when I talked to Ray Boyer, I asked him this question about the changes he had seen in Dow over his career there, and he said the biggest difficulty was the institution of 50 cash registers.
Of what?
50 cash registers. He said that when H.H. Dow had the company, there was one cash register.
Yeah.
And so that if one lab could help support the other.
Yes.
But now that you have 50 cash registers, it doesn't work that way. And
yeah.
So it tends to stifle the creativity.
Yeah, I can see that.
The startup time that you need, because you have a very narrow and defined region in which you're working.
That's a good point.
But that was his term. He called it 50 cash registers instead of one.
That sounds like Ray Boyer.
Let me ask you that same question. What changes did you see? What would you, looking back now over your career at Dow, what are the more important changes that you saw in your career there?
I'm thinking of research now.
Mm-hmm.
Red tape. All kinds, government red tape, everything, can't help but slow down research. The emphasis on safety without spending additional money to make it possible to do things as quickly as we used to do them and do them safely. Sure, it's possible to operate a safe lab and do nothing, or essentially nothing, but to do things as we used to do without regard to safety, but do them safely, means maybe doubling the capital investment. But if you double the capital investment so that anybody can do something, he can run an experiment immediately and do it safely. And that's altogether possible. And I think those are the big changes. And maybe that comes out to be the same as Ray Boyer's 50 cash registers, too.
When you mentioned red tape, and you especially identified the government. Has the company put a lot of red tape?
Yes, the company has also. Company has. There are just so many restrictions.
Do you think that's due to the fact that there are fewer scientists at the upper levels making those decisions? At least that's what I sense, that there were fewer scientists. If you look back over the period of your career at Dow, there were more scientists who worked their way into management positions and positions of decision. And I'm not sure that's the case today.
And it's not the case today. Most of the very top people are financial people today. And that's a big difference. And maybe that may have a real influence, too. But they should be able to understand, and the director of research should be independent enough that he would carry on his program regardless of what, well, I shouldn't say regardless of what he was told, but almost that. He should assume responsibility. That's what I should have said.
When you were director of research, what kind of voice did you have in major decisions within the company? Were you
as a member of the board of directors and the vice president and responsible, at least most of that time, to the president of the company? Mm-hmm. I had all I needed, and if I needed more, I could have had it. And I think anybody could do the same thing if they just assumed that they had it.
Mm-hmm. So you were there at a period where there was strong support for the kinds of programs you were operating.
Yes. Yes.
And that came from Doan. Was Doan a strong supporter of research and following the mold of the Dows? Even though he wasn't a technically oriented person, was he?
He was. I guess I'm not absolutely sure what his education was. He was head of the sales department, mm-hmm. but he must have been technically oriented.
But he certainly supported.
Oh yes, he supported just as much as anybody else. He probably left it more to me than Willard Dow did. Willard knew exactly what was going on all the time, every day.
I see.
And Willard Dow had the patience and the perseverance to spend a lot of research money during the Depression, when other companies were cutting back and when other companies were failing to take advantage of the opportunity, and when technical help was cheap and very good. And Willard Dow really went all out during that period of time.
The Depression did not, as I understand it, affect Dow like it did so many other places. I mean,
no.
It had an effect, but it certainly wasn't a disastrous effect.
No, it didn't affect Dow, really. I don't, except to travel around the country and see what was going on. In Midland, we hardly realized there was a depression. That's quite right. If you look at the charts, there was a depression. Sales did go down some, but they picked up very quickly. I think 32 was the bottom for us, and then after that, things improved. So we really didn't see it.
And what would you attribute that to? Was that
I think the chemical industry as a whole was not hit as hard as the rest of the industry. Other than that, and well, the chemical industry was growing and growing very fast, and I suspect that was true with the rest of the chemical industry too.